In recent weeks on Art Scene, we've had a chance to talk with directors and actors involved in three different regional productions of the award-winning musical 1776. All agree that putting on 1776 in 2026 is a passion project rooted in their understanding of the power of the story as it's told and the power of theater to break through and often bring people together. Today we'll hear from Adam Randis, Artistic Director of the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts in Hazleton, and from two actors from PTPA's upcoming production. Adam explains he's played the role of John Adams in other productions, and he would have truly loved to do so this time too, but he also recognizes the need for strong direction to make the musical all that it can be. Adam Randis has used this phrase before, and we'll hear him say it again shortly. He says, 1776 is the musical of my soul. What does he mean by that? If we check with others online, we find what amount to testimonials almost. And perhaps if you haven't seen the show recently or at all, you might think these observations are in some measure exaggerated. But let's just follow along. If you ever find yourself sitting through 1776, you quickly realize it's kind of a wild concept for a musical. For the first 2 hours or so, it operates less like a traditional Broadway show and more like a high-stakes, hyper-caffeinated courtroom drama. It's a room full of men in vestcoats and powdered wigs arguing over property rights, trade routes, and syntax. It is loud, it is funny, and it's incredibly wordy. But then, right before the finish line, the show pulls the rug out from under us with the song, Is Anybody There? And to understand why this song matters so much, we have to look at John Adams. Throughout the whole show, Adams is a walking headache. He's obnoxious, he's disliked, and he's a political steamroller. He's pure, unadulterated momentum. And then, suddenly, he is completely alone. The stage goes dark, the shouting matches stop, and Adams is left holding a grim letter from George Washington, basically saying, hey, we are losing this war badly. The brilliance of Is Anybody There starts right in those first few quiet seconds. When Adams sings, Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? He's not talking to Congress anymore. He's talking to the walls. He's talking to history. He is talking to us sitting in the audience. It strips away all his political armor and exposes this profound, terrifying isolation. It's the moment the audience realizes that Adams isn't just an annoying politician. He's a man standing on a cliff, entirely by himself, trying to pull a country into existence by sheer force of will. What makes this song an emotional gut punch, though, is how it shifts gears halfway through. Adams starts having this almost manic, prophetic vision of the future. He starts singing about fireworks and ringing bells and kids celebrating in the streets. If you think about it, it's incredibly heartbreaking. We, the audience, have known those moments. We, every 4th of July, experience fireworks and ringing bells and children celebrating in the streets. But Adams is trapped here in a dark room in 1776. Genuinely believing that if this vote fails, he is going to be publicly hanged for treason. He's dreaming up a world he might never get to see. Musically, it's just pure catharsis. Whether it's William Daniels doing his famous strained staccato delivery back in the day, or modern productions blowing the roof off the theater with a massive belt, the song forces the actor to push their voice to its absolute physical limit. By the time Adams screams out that he sees Americans, all Americans, free forevermore. It doesn't sound like a pretty Broadway melody anymore. It sounds like a desperate prayer.
Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? They want me to quit. They say, John, give up the fight. Still to England I say, good night, forever good night. For I have crossed the Rubicon. Let the bridge be burnt behind me. Come what may, come what may. Commit bond! The croakers all say we'll rue the day. They'll be held to pay in fiery purgatory. Through all the gloom, through all the gloom, I can see the rays of ravishing light and glory. Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? I see fireworks. I see the pageant and pomp and parade. I hear the bells ringing out. I hear the cannons roar. I see Americans, all Americans, free forevermore.
How quiet the chamber is. How silent the chamber is. Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see?
Is anybody there? Takes the founding fathers off their pedestals and reminds us that they were not myths or marble statues. They were terrified, exhausted human beings who had to gamble everything on an impossible dream. It's the beating heart of the show, and it's the reason that the final roll call feels less like a historical technicality and more like a miracle. For Adam Randis and most of those involved in regional productions of 1776 to mark America 250, those sentiments may ring true. And we'll have a chance to take in 1776 over the next three weekends as presented by the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, two times in Hazleton, the third weekend in Lehighton. Director Adam Randis and Kieran Burke, who has the role of John Adams, and David Zimmerman, who plays Ben Franklin, all gathered at the Art Scene table to talk about 1776 and its importance. Adam Randis.
I first saw the film in seventh grade civics class because my teacher was like, I don't want to teach for a week. So he showed 1776 and I absolutely fell in love with it. If I didn't know at that point that I was going to become a history teacher, I think that solidified it. Seeing Mr. Feeney, as I knew him then from Boy Meets World, as John Adams was revelatory. And, you know, that's kind of a 1-2 punch for me, really going down the route of getting my degrees in history and education, but then also being more heavily involved in theater. And it's fascinating to teach history and to have delved into the primary sources. And so many of the people who are in this play left behind copious letters and correspondence. Two of them became president. Three, if you count Washington off stage. But what's fascinating about the show is, you know, sometimes they play fast and loose with the history, but they don't ever really, I feel, play fast and loose with the meaning of the history, mm-hmm. with the the zeitgeist of the time, with the debates that were going on in colonial America at the time, and with the feeling and the tenor and really a lot of the complicated issues of the period. And one thing that I really enjoyed about 1776, even as a seventh grade student, was that these are people on that stage. They're not archetypes. They're not, they even say history is going to look at us as demigods, but we're not. We're just people. We're regular men. We make mistakes. We have foibles. We, in the case of, you know, Franklin, you know, we have lusts and we have desires. And, mm-hmm. And in the case of John Adams, we make mistakes. And I think to be able to paint these people who normally we just see as John Trumbull paintings in this full light of being people with all of the contradictions therein is something that really is wonderful. And Franklin is so wonderfully fully realized as a character. He has so many dimensions. Adams has so many dimensions. Jefferson, John Dickinson, right down the line. And they're true to something. I mean, they might not always be true to that individual person, although I feel like Adams and Franklin in particular are very, very well realized. But in the case of your antagonists to the show, your John Dickinson, your Edward Rutledge, they're true to something that was going on at the time, even if not that particular historical personage.
Kieran, we know that you were immersed through your family in both music and in history. Aside from wanting to play a really good part, what else have you been thinking about in taking the role of John Adams here?
I mean, I've known the show since, well, the movie, but the movie is very faithful to the show. And I've known the show since I was very young. My mother showed it to me. It's kind of funny because the song he plays the violin, she used to tell me that when I wouldn't be practicing my violin as a child. And I always, John Adams is a part that I've wanted to play since I was too young to play it. And I'm probably still too young. And I mean, you know, it's something about like looking at the country as it is now and what it has been, what it could be, what we maybe want it to be. And it's an interesting time and place to be having this celebration and to be thinking about these themes as an actor and as a creative person.
Ben, what about Poor Richard's Almanac and that history of Ben and printing and words and the dialogue that you engage in here?
Yeah, I got to research some of that. There really isn't much of him personally mentioned in the script. It does talk a little bit about his relationship with his son, who was the governor of New Jersey at the time, and that they weren't getting along because he was appointed royally. So you know, there was a bit of a conflict there. And he does reach out to Europe in the script a little bit about how the decoration is important for that, for other countries to know what, well, the would-be United States is trying to accomplish. But there's not much in the script, so I did do some reading. I was surprised to find out that just about a year before our story takes place, he had just gotten through with about 16 or 17 years in London. He had lived for many years in England. And one of the reasons he came back was because he saw that, obviously, Lexington and Concord had already happened, and I think that was probably a motivating factor for coming back, that he think independence was going to be.
When Franklin goes into Congress, everyone acknowledges him. He's the elder statesman of the Continental Congress, and then he would go on to be the elder statesman of the Constitutional Convention and of America writ large. He already was a mythical figure by the time of 1776. And yet here he is, you know, making poop jokes like everybody else. Yeah. Is.
We've heard you say, Adam, that you have played the role of John Adams a number of times. So you've gotten inside John Adams and you're a history prof, so you know the larger story than just what's in the show. Talk a little bit about the character of John Adams.
Adams is such a unique role in musical theater. He's a lead, whereas normally that kind of character would not be a lead. And it's the fact that history places him there. But You also have the show itself is so strange for a musical. Also, there's very famously a 32-minute stretch of no song in 1776. They tried to place a song somewhere in there, like, nah, we just have to let Congress debate for an extended period of time. And that song is Anybody There. It's you can debate about where the climax of the show is, whether or not it's Molasses to Rum, but really the 11 o'clock number is sung by a quote unquote non-singer in William Daniels. But it's such a plaintive, evocative song, Is Anybody There? And what it talks about, what it thinks about, what it ruminates on. To be that late in the show and that emotionally powerful is very difficult for an actor, I know, but it's such a joy.
Well, sort of circling back to why I wanted to be involved, I mean, why I that song is a big part of it. Something that as an actor I really latched onto. And part of the joy of doing the whole show is the, maybe it's trite to talk about the journey, but to get to that point, because John is so forceful and single-minded the whole time. And he doesn't allow himself that kind of doubt about what he's attempting to accomplish. But then there comes that point where he has to sort of reckon with the way that nobody else is really there to carry through what he sees for what this country could be. And it's interesting to kind of look at it through my own eyes as a person, and whether or not I in some ways agree with John. But John is so committed.
Is Franklin a moderating figure in the course of these discussions, would you say?
A bit. I think he talks John away from the edge a little bit, especially in regards to slavery. Franklin was definitely it says in the script that he was a founder of one of the first anti-slavery societies on the continent, which I did a little research on that, and I think that was a couple of years after.
It was later.
But they take liberties, but the fact remains, he brought it to Congress's attention that anti-slavery is something people were moving in the direction of. But yeah, as far as John Adams, he's a bit moderate, because John Adams is so hot-headed, and so any kind of has to be. I think every kind of revolution needs that kind of a fire, even though, you know, he bent a lot of people the wrong way and, mm-hmm. you know, pushed a lot of buttons people didn't want pushed. And so I think Ben, to some extent, had to pull him back a little bit.
You'll see that in any revolutionary movement. I think what's interesting about Franklin is he's not a moderate, but he's moderating. It's like you look at revolutionary movements throughout history and you'll see something similar. Martin Luther King was revolutionary, but he was still moderating in his way of trying to bring about revolution. You have Gandhi and Nehru. You have Malcolm X as a foil to King. But and there's also a generational thing there oftentimes as well. You have this older generation who is trying to find a more conciliatory way or a open way of trying to get change to happen.
Right. But there's no doubt that Ben was definitely for independence the way. But at the same time, he had a better idea on how to negotiate that than John Adams.
And how to sell it. And we would know later on how to sell it to France. You know, Franklin's one of the people that got France and the Battle of Saratoga. But, you know, Franklin's one of the people who got France to actually recognize the United States, join in the war effort. And the United States wouldn't exist if France did not join that war effort after. So it's
no question.
Something that's oftentimes forgot to history, but, you know, it's Franklin working behind the scenes with others in the court in France that was able to do that because he had that way of being able to reach out across aisles and reach out across cultures and nations in order to do that. But I think also what Dave says is very smart in that you also need those people who are the firebrands. You need those people who are going to push. You need those people who are going to be annoyances, who are going to be gadflies, who are going to rub people the wrong way, because they're the ones who get change to happen.
What about the powerful song Rutledge sings? And we were talking about slavery. Tell us about the power of that song and its place in the show.
I think that's one of the things that really makes 1776 what it is the fact that, and we talked about this with the cast the other day, too. It's not a quote-unquote happy ending show. I mean, everyone signs the Declaration of Independence, and it's not like, oh, there's a big sigh of relief. The reality is, from the moment that they actually out loud talk about the elephant in the room, which is the fact that Americans are talking about freedom and equality and talking about universal rights, and there are over 500,000 people who are enslaved in America at the time, for whom those rights are not going to be available, according to many of the folks in that room. And that dichotomy, what is even called by members of the South hypocrisy in talking about that, is something that colors the show before it's mentioned, but also is going to color the show very much from after it's mentioned. From the moment that they mention, hey, there is a very substantive paragraph in this document that Thomas Jefferson wrote that is anti-slavery. Now, yes, it blames King George for slavery, which is not historically accurate, but it does state, which was a belief of Jefferson and of, I would honestly say, many of the people in that room, that slavery was, they called it an execrable practice. It was literally crappy, like literally human excrement is how they described this. And it was a barbaric thing.
And it remains a blemish on our history to this day. I mean, even audience members will probably shift a little uncomfortably in their seat listening to this song.
And also listening to the debate that Franklin and Adams have afterwards about whether or not to cut the slavery clause from the Declaration. Because the bottom line is that America was, for better and for worse, a compromised birth. It's a birth of freedom, and it's a birth of saying, we're going to make a nation, not because people have lived here forever, not because there's a specific ethnicity that has lived in this place that we're claiming as our own, but the whole idea of America being birthed by the Declaration of Independence and then the Constitution is that it's a country that's based on ideas. And those ideas are high-minded. Those ideas are lofty. Those ideas are humanism, the idea that everyone deserves to be treated the same. The idea that the law should not separate people and treat people differently, that there is an innate specialness to humanity that society needs to respect and society needs to honor. The sad thing was that in 1776, America and the European world weren't ready to cash the check that Thomas Jefferson and the folks in that room were writing. And that tension is there when Edward Rutledge calls it out and says, hey, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you wrote this. You're a slave owner. Jefferson says, oh, well, I've resolved to release my slaves. He didn't in his lifetime. John Adams and Stephen Hopkins from Rhode Island say, you know, this is it's a horrible, execrable practice. You know, it's a stinking business. And Rutledge from South Carolina brings up, how do you think those slaves get here? New England builds the ships. Rhode Island is the port, and Massachusetts are the Boston are the ports that they leave from. They're built by New Englanders. They're staffed by New Englanders and people from the middle colonies. The triangle trade, which is actually kind of like a quadrangle trade between the Americas, Europe, Africa, and the Caribbean, is stocked by New England and the middle colonies and all of the United States. And they're all making money off of it. And even if the New England colonies have moved away from it, and some, not all, in the middle colonies have moved away from it, the basis of their wealth and their power is there in slavery. They can say, oh, we're above that now, but they weren't above that to get where they were.
For their economy.
Yeah, exactly.
The term they use in the show is their personal economy, that if you give up the slavery, it will hurt your economy. And John Adams calls about economy. It's always about economy.
And, you know, they're going to kick that can down the road to 1861, but that can keeps getting kicked in so many ways. And I think the fact that this show is willing to wrestle with that in a way that is in the audience's face is to its credit. It's not hagiography. It's not saying, oh, look at these guys. They say funny things. They have barbs back and forth with each other. They do that because they did at the time. But there are very real, serious, and substantive issues that are brought up by this show. And to this show's credit, are not fully resolved by this show. Because in so many ways, we are still dealing with the issues that were not solved in 1776. The end of the show, when everyone signs the Declaration, it's not this triumphant, happy moment with, you know, major chords and angels flying. It's minor chords. The Liberty Bell drones on because they know that in many ways they're signing their death warrants. They believe a week later, Philadelphia is going to be taken over by the British, as every major city the British eyed up would be taken over. But also they know that what they're creating is not this perfect form of government, this perfect idea, that there's something that is lost, or at the very least something that is not gained by the decisions that they have to make in that room that they feel at the time in order for what they say is a greater good. And history and we are still here to think about what is the greater good in these circumstances. And it's not an easy answer. It really isn't. And I think that's one of the things that pulls me back to the show so often, is that it's a show that is aspirational about what America can be. And at the same time, in 1776, they're like, I want America to be this. And it's not in 1776. 250 years later, we look and say, I want America to be this. And it's not this yet, perhaps, for many people. And I think that's the thing about this show that I keep coming back to, is it continues to be aspirational because we need to continue to be aspirational.
You've been telling us how committed and how much of a firebrand John Adams is tell us a little bit more about his complex character.
John Adams is fascinating because he's a character. Like John Adams puts on John Adams. He puts on the role of the gadfly. He puts on the role of the provocateur. And it's only in those moments with Abigail and the moment where he's by himself that you see the introspective side of him that we know is there from his letters, that we know is there from his private correspondence. And it's so brilliant that the show's able to do that, to have Adams the almost like a clown, like the role that he takes on himself. He takes on the burden of being a punching bag for Independence. But at the same time, he's pushing for something that he feels is so much greater and so much more. And the way that the show's able to give us those moments with Abigail dramatizing their letters, but then also that dramatic moment of just, it's a man on a stage, and that's it. It's a man on a stage with a letter. And it's one of, I feel, the most powerful moments in musical theater.
In this particular production, in your relationship, John, with Abigail, why is that important, do you think, to the show?
It kind of goes off of what Adam was saying. It's a different side to John. It's a more real and a more human side to John that we don't see when he's interacting with Congress and interacting with both his allies and his enemies. There's an aspect of the show that nobody really likes him. Like, even the people who are on his side do not like having to work with him on this because he's so annoying. But yes, having time with Abigail is, it shows that other side to him. It also, it humanizes him, and it brings in that reality of the home life.
The multidimensionality. And John gets that thanks to Abigail, but it's a shame to say, well, then does Abigail, you know, does 1776 pass the Bechdel test? But at the same time, I think what the show gets right is that she is fully his equal.
Yes.
She is as smart as he is, more emotionally intelligent than he is.
She's
certainly
No less right in the thing. She's taking yes. care of the entire family who are mostly sick or they don't have materials.
And backed by the historical record that the famous letter about, you know, remember the ladies, right, talks about the idea that for so many men, they are a tyrant to the opposite sex. But all that I ask is that they be like you and be a friend. And that's why they sign their letters to each other, my dearest friend, because that implies something that really wasn't a reality for so many people in 1776, a co-equality in their relationship. And the fact that John has that with Abby fills in so many details about him.
Marriages were still a business arrangement at that time.
Absolutely, yeah. And yet here these two are. They are partners, fully partners in life, equal partners in life. My dearest friend, not my wife, not my husband. And I think that tells you so much without having to tell you so much. And the scenes with John and Abby they're some of the most emotionally affecting in the show because I think Kieran nailed it. They're real. And we know they're real because literally they're taking words from their letters to each other. It's so close to the history. It's so close to the real relationship that they had. And the fact that Peter Stone was able to work with Sherman Edwards to do that, to fully realize that, is such a special thing.
And what about Thomas Jefferson and his partner?
Oh, Martha.
We at least get to meet Martha. She comes to Philadelphia.
Yeah, and Jaden Culp is playing Martha Jefferson, and she's so vivacious, you know, she's so full of life. And that's kind of what that part calls for. You know, she comes out for one scene and one song. He plays the violin, but it's such a fun song. And in the middle of the show, it's okay to just have fun sometimes, too. It's okay to just revel in the company of the people that you love. And that's kind of what Martha brings out. And it's in its own way another humanizing element, or at least adding to the dimensionality of these people. Kit McElver is playing Abigail, and this is actually her first show at the PTPA. She has the groundedness and the reality in Abigail. I mean, sometimes you have to sacrifice, you know, can someone be a good actor or can someone be a good singer?
And Kit's both.
And it's so great. It's so great because she modulates just the right level of really, John, with Kieran, and the interplay is so good. And you don't always get that. I have nothing but the greatest confidence in this group of people. And to have this fully realized picture of what I call it, the show of my soul in 1776. Head, heart, and soul. So I managed to put Fiddler on the Roof on this season, which is the show of my heart. This is the show of my soul. We can do it.
You give us a number of times to experience the show. Tell us how.
Well, our opening weekend is 4th of July weekend, actually. We open on Friday, July 3rd, and we're also going to be running our show on the 4th of July. What better way to celebrate the 250th than coming to the PTPA to see 1776? So our Friday and Saturday shows are at 7 p.m., and then we have a Sunday matinee on the 5th at 2 p.m. Then the following weekend, we're going to be back at the PTPA with a show on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday again. But for our second weekend, we're bringing back the PTPA dinner for our Saturday and Sunday shows. So the 10th, 11th, and 12th, the 11th and 12th will both have a dinner. Dinner is served an hour and 30 minutes before curtain. So 5:30 on Saturday, 12:30 on Sunday. And dinner reservations are due by Monday, July 6th. So all of that is available on the PTPA's website, ptpashows.org. And then, really exciting.
Yes, the third weekend, we're moving the show. The first probably traveling PTPA show to Lehighton, Pennsylvania, which is where I am from. We're celebrating the 250th in a lot of different ways. Fireworks and concerts and things of that nature. And some people from the borough approached me and said, hey, how about we do 1776? Now, I wasn't prepared. It's hard to get 20 or 30 male actors on stage, even on a stage like PTPA. So I said, well, maybe I can talk these guys to come do shows in Lehighton the third weekend, the 17th and the 18th, starting at 7 p.m. Same thing. To get tickets for that production, go to Pale Moon. Just search for Pale Moon Tickets. That's the name of our group, or go to Ludus and type in Pale Moon. That's where we're selling the tickets from. But yeah, if you're in the Lehigh Valley or closer to Lehighton, or you're going to be away, I know a friend that's going to be away on vacation for the first two weekends, you can come to Lehighton for the third weekend and we'll be happy to have you. And that'll raise money for my nonprofit, a theater group in Lehighton.
And that's in cooperation with the Carbon County America 250. Yes. They helped to facilitate this. So we're taking part in that. It's an interesting thing in terms of, you know, set design to think about how can we make a set that's transportable from one stage to another with some differences. And so we're doing a bit more of an impressionistic set. The walls are see-through in order to use color accentuation, etc. And also, I'm very honored to say that for the first time at the PTPA, our set is being designed by Michael Gallagher. And Michael Gallagher, one of my favorite people, and also pretty well established as one of the best set designers this area has ever seen. And what I found out, and I did not know, is that 1776 is actually the first set that Michael ever designed. He designed it for a production in 1975. So literally 50 years later, he's revamped his design based on the things that I asked him for, based on the ability to make it movable. And it's a completely different design, too. But just to see those Michael Gallagher drafts, you know, in front of you on graph paper, it's just like, it's an honor. And Michael also played John Adams in a Music Box production, probably multiple Music Box productions.
The first Music Box production of 1776, Michael Gallagher played John Adams. And that production, I believe, was directed by Kevin Costley, who is in our production.
Yes. And also played John Dickinson. And Larry Voigtko was in that production as well. So there's also a WVIA connection there. So the Music Box and Michael have a very close relationship with this show as well. And just for Michael to be able to say, you know, 50 years apart, I'm able to set design 1776 is such a wonderful thing and such a special thing for us to be able to have that happen.
Mr. Secretary, is the declaration ready to be signed?
It is.
Very well. Call the roll.
New Hampshire, Dr. Josiah Bartlett. Massachusetts, Mr. John Adams. Rhode Island, Mr. Stephen Hopkins. Connecticut, Mr. Roger Sherman. New York, Mr. Lewis Morris. New Jersey, the Reverend Jonathan Witherspoon. Pennsylvania, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. Delaware, Mr. Caesar Rodney. Maryland, Mr. Samuel Chase. Virginia, Mr. Thomas Jefferson. North Carolina, Mr. Joseph Hughes. South Carolina, Mr. Edward Franklin. Georgia, Dr. Lyman Hall.
The finale of the award-winning musical 1776. We heard from a director and two actors, in fact, for the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts. director Adam Randis, actors Kieran Burke, who has the role of John Adams, and David Zimmerman, who plays Ben Franklin. There will be shows this weekend and next in Hazleton, and then, as we heard, they'll be moving on to Lehighton for the following weekend, the weekend of July 17th. So let's review what we've been told. It's the award-winning Broadway musical 1776, presented by the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts. And the show opens on Friday, July 3rd, and runs the 3rd and the 4th, actually the 4th of July, at 7, that's curtain time. And there's a matinee that weekend, July 5th, at 2. The following weekend, July 10th, Friday evening at 7. And then they're inviting us to dinner, and we'll bet there's Yankee pot roast and more. Saturday, July 11th, there's a 5:30 dinner and a 7 p.m. curtain. Sunday, July 12th, a 12:30 dinner and a 2 p.m. curtain. You don't have to go to dinner, but if you like, that's an option. And so you can find all the details about the reservations and so forth online at ptpashows.org, ptpashows.org. And you can find the theater at 212 West Broad Street in Hazleton. That's 1776, presented by the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, Friday and Saturday, July 3rd and 4th at 7, Sunday the 5th at 2, and then again, Friday the 10th at 7, Saturday the 11th at 7, and Sunday at 2. But on the 11th and 12th, you have the option of joining them for dinner at 5:30 and 12:30. And then on to Lehighton. They will present the musical 1776 at Lehighton Area High School Auditorium. That's 1 Indian Lane in Lehighton. And that's July 17th and 18th at 7 p.m. And for more information, tickets and so forth for that production, it's thepalemoonplayers.ludus.com, L-U-D-U-S, thepalemoonplayers.ludus.com. And you can join in with the folks in Hazleton the first two weekends, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and again the 10th, 11th, and 12th, or pick up on the 17th and 18th in Lehighton. For more information on the web, ptpashows.org, ptpashows.org.